Hello, this is Lois Pausch reading the Vermilion County News for Friday, January the 12th, 2018. I have to keep reminding myself of the new year. And the first article has the headline, Letters Go Out for Rental Registration. Vacant Structure Registration Marks 10th Year. Dateline Danville, about 3,100 letters have been going out this week for the city's rental registration program. City Code Enforcement Inspectors Don Cruz, Kenny Harden, and Jim Mahary on Thursday were finishing up the last of the letters to mail. They will hand deliver letters to the bigger local owners, saving the city postage money, Cruz said. The property owners have until February 16th to register rental units and pay a fee of $15 per unit. Under city ordinance, all rental dwellings shall be registered each calendar year. Mahary said they have good response. There are usually only a few who don't respond and pay the fee. Also, vacant structure letters will soon be mailed. Those are still being finalized. The city also requires certain vacant buildings be registered annually. That city ordinance went into effect 10 years ago. The city defines a vacant building as a building unoccupied and unsecured, secured by other than normal means, unsafe, illegally occupied, or which an enforcement officer has issued an order to correct code violations. There were 74 vacant structure registrations for the past year, according to Danville Planning and Urban Services Manager Chris Milliken. Under city ordinance, the annual fee to register a residential building is $50, and to register a commercial building is $100. In addition to the fee, if the building remains vacant for more than 1 year and no significant repairs are being made, there is an additional annual fee of $500 until the building is properly rehabilitated or demolished. The owner of a vacant building also is to maintain insurance in an amount sufficient to secure repairs or demolition. Vacant building plans also must be submitted and approved. Exemptions include a building that is actively marketed for sale or rent for a 12-month period. And the next article has the headline, DHS Northridge Show Choirs to Perform. Dateline Danville. The Danville High School Choral Boosters will host Prima Vista, a virtual spaghetti dinner and first look at the award-winning DHS and Northridge Middle School Show Choir's 2018 shows next week. This is the second time Northridge's Redcoats and Radiant Reds have been invited to perform it at a Prima Vista. The doors open at 6:30 p.m. January 18th at Danville High School's Dick Van Dyke Auditorium, with the concert beginning at 7 p.m. The event is open to the public, and Northridge's Show Choir Boosters will sell concessions. There is no admission, but we're encouraging families to donate pasta or spaghetti sauce that will be donated to the St. James Food Pantry, Sean Owen of the DHS Choral Boosters said. Boosters. Sorry, I'll get that right yet. Anyone in the committee can come. Owen said it was decided not to charge admission this year because the boosters wanted it to be a community event. We want to pack the house. The idea for a virtual spaghetti dinner was hatched several years ago. The audience won't be actually eating a spaghetti dinner, but rather donating the food to help others. The spaghetti sauce, pasta, and canned goods will be collected inside the high school's main doors at the Circle Drive to help restock the community food pantry at St. James United Methodist Church. The Prima Vista will give the community a sneak peek at the performances the DHS and Northridge show choirs have been working on before they present them at competition. This will be a review of all the shows this year, DHS Choral Director Jeff Thomas said. The competition numbers of the DHS Contemporaries delegation and the executives, as well as the shows that the Northridge show choirs will perform this spring in Nashville, will be showcased that evening. Northridge's Redcoats and Radiant Reds show choirs are set to compete in the March at the Show Choir Nationals that will take place at the Grand Ole Opry. The last time a Northridge show choir participated in the event was in 2009. The Redcoats performance will entail retelling the Jungle Book with rock and roll tunes, while the Radiant Reds will tell the tale of a waitress who dreams of becoming a dancer with songs by Sarah Bareilles and Meghan Trainor, and from the show's Chorus Line and Fame. They, the show choirs, will be performing the full shows, Owen said. The middle school groups will start out the show, followed by the executives, contemporaries, and delegations, Thomas said. The executives, an all-male show choir group, will perform their I Love the 90s show featuring songs from the 1990s. The all-female contemporary show will feature postmodern jukebox 1920s-style arrangements. They will be doing pop songs from recent years and rearranging them to sound like they are from the 20s, Thomas said. The mixed voice group delegation show, All Who Wander, is basically a traveling show about self-discovery, Thomas said. Delegation's female members will be dressed in blue gowns that look like a world map designed by Thomas's wife, Cassie, a first grade teacher at Beet Park Elementary School. She designed them and she does the choreography for them, he said. Thomas said the best part of the show could possibly be the lighting and set design, all built by Creative District 118 parents. The lighting and set designs is beyond anything I've ever seen professionally or personally, he said. And now an article with the headline, Code Enforcement Inspectors Move Back to City Hall. Dateline Danville. After about 10 years at the Public Works facility on Vurey Street, the city's code enforcement inspectors are back at City Hall. The four inspectors are in office space at the Robert E. Jones Municipal Building, 17 West Main Street, where they used to be housed. They now report to the city's legal department and corporation counsel, David Wessner. The city's legal department is on the second floor of City Hall on the north side of the building. The property code inspectors also are on the second floor of City Hall. The four inspectors are Rick Brown, Don Cruz, Jim Meharry, and Kenny Harden. They continue to handle different areas of the city. A code enforcement map and their assigned areas can be found on the city's website at www.cityofdanvilleallonword.org. Common code enforcement issues include tall grass, inoperable vehicles, trash and litter in a yard, and general property maintenance. Rental and vacant building registration will again be at City Hall. Letters being sent to property owners have indicated the location change, Eisenhower said. Eisenhower said when the property code inspector started to report to Danville Engineering and Urban Services Director David Schnelli, instead of former Public Works Director Doug Ahrens, we realized the disconnect between legal and code enforcement. Now with the two divisions at City Hall, there's more of a connection with issues and cases. Eisenhower said the city won't be dealing with the salary chart until May. That's when employee workloads, such as the one for Wessner, will be looked at again. He also noted public interaction with the code enforcement inspectors happens more out in the field and at properties. Meharry said they try to be proactive. We're dealing with people face-to-face daily, he said. Meharry said they're settling in on the second floor of City Hall. He said it's a natural fit with the inspectors regularly dealing with the legal department. It made sense, Eisenhower said, after having them at City Hall, also with the finance department that can collect vacant and rental registration fees. City officials continue to hear people say the Code Enforcement Inspection Division is anti-business and is unfair. Eisenhower disagrees, saying it's a great scapegoat for wanting no accountability. Yes, we have codes and expectations by the public to stay in or do business in a safe environment, he added. Eisenhower also says the city treats everyone equally and fairly. Everyone is treated exactly the same, he said, even though some people ask the city to give certain individuals or businesses a break and go after others. And now for the obituaries. And the first is for L. Rose Quinlan, 81 of Danville, who died on Wednesday, January 10th, 2018. A graveside service will be at 2 p.m. Friday, January 12th, that's today, at the Danville National Cemetery. Officiating will be Pastor Alan Rudy. Sunset Funeral Home has been entrusted with the arrangements. Memorial donations may be made to the Shriners Hospital or Faith Baptist Church of Danville. And the next is for Marilyn Jabing, 66, of Danville, and formerly of Perrysville, Indiana, who died on Tuesday, January 9th at St. Vincent, Indianapolis Hospital. Funeral services will be at 3 p.m. Eastern Time Saturday, January 13th, at DeVerter Funeral Home in Cayuga, Indiana. Officiating will be Bob Fairchild and Reverend Jason Dean. Visitation will be from 1 o'clock Eastern Time Saturday, January 13th, until time of the service. Due to changing weather conditions, burial will be at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, January 14th, at Hicks Cemetery in Perrysville, Indiana. The family requests contributions to the Kirk Gentrup Memorial Scholarship Fund, 5551 North Falcon Drive, Cayuga, Indiana, 47928. And the next is for Inez Ann Wheeler, 83, of Attica, Indiana, who died on Wednesday, January 10th, at home. A celebration of Inez's life will be at 2 p.m. Central Time, Sunday, January 14th, at Sunsets Houghton Leisure Funeral Home, 200 East West Street in Georgetown, with Pastor James Blue officiating. Visitation will be from 5 to 8 p.m. Saturday, January 13th, at the funeral home. She will be laid to rest in Michael's Cemetery, Indianola. Memorial donations may be given in her name to the American Cancer Society. And the next is for George R. Powell, 51, of Westville, who died on Tuesday, January 9th. A celebration of George's life will be at 11 a.m. Saturday, January 13, at Sunset Urbis Funeral Home, 414 South State Street, Westville, with Kevin Cox officiating. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, January 12th, at the funeral home. He will be laid to rest in Sunset Memorial Park, Danville. Memorial donations may be given to the family to help with final expenses. And the next is for Jesse Lee Davis, Sr., 73, who died on January 4th at Decatur Memorial Hospital. Homecoming celebration will commence at noon Saturday, January 13th, at New Life Church of Faith, 1419 North Bowman Avenue. Visitation will be at 11 a.m. Saturday until the time of the service. Officiating will be Pastor Leo E. Davis. Interment will be in Spring Hill Cemetery. And the next is for James Henry Streben, Streibin, 90, who died on December 30th at Colonial Manor in Danville. Visitation will be from 1 to 2:30 p.m. Saturday, January 13th, at Sunset Funeral Home, 3940 North Vermillion Street, Danville, Illinois, 61834. A celebration of life will be at 2:30 p.m. at the funeral home. Ramey Gordon will officiate. Burial will be in Sunset Memorial Park, with military rites accorded by American Legion Post 210. Memorials may be made in Jim's name to the American Legion Post 210 or the American Cancer Society. And now we go back to news articles. And the first one has the title, "Danville Man 18 Found Dead from Gunshot Wound." Dateline Danville. An 18-year-old man was found dead of an apparent gunshot wound in the 1000 block of Glenwood Thursday morning, according to Public Safety Director Larry Thomason. Danville police responded to a report of what appeared to be a person slumped over in a vehicle at about 8:30 a.m. Thursday. Officers arriving at the scene discovered a male inside the vehicle, Thomason said in a release. Further investigation found evidence of a gunshot wound to that person. The incident is being investigated as a homicide, and the name of the victim will not be released, pending notification to the family by the Vermillion County Coroner. This is the first homicide recorded in Vermillion County in 2018. The investigation is ongoing, and no further details were being released Thursday afternoon. But persons with information about the incident are asked to contact Danville Police at 431-2250 or through Crime Stoppers at 446-TIPS. And the next article has the headline, Pair Arrested on Charges of Prostitution Trafficking. Dateline, Lafayette, Indiana. Two Danville residents were arrested Sunday morning after Lafayette police received complaints on possible prostitution at a hotel in the 100 block of Frontage Road. Darius J. Brown, 27, was a suspect in the complaint and left the hotel with two women. Police followed his vehicle and stopped him in the 3900 block of South Street, where they arrested him and Brandy L. Miles, 18. Brown, of the 1000 block of Hazel Street in Danville, was charged with human trafficking, promoting prostitution, and providing alcohol to minors. Brown posted bond and has since been released, according to Lieutenant Thomas Amos. Brown also faces four counts of domestic battery from April 2017 in Vermilion County, according to court records. Miles of the 1100 block of Franklin Street in Danville was charged with possession of a legend drug. Thomas said police records show the drug was fluoxetine hydrochloride, an antidepressant that carries the warning of suicide risk for children, adolescents, and young adults. Miles' bond is set at $250, and she remains in custody. Another 18-year-old woman was in the vehicle with Brown and Miles. Police said she was a sexual trafficking victim and was taken to a trusted family member in the area. And another article with the headline, Oakwood Threat Came from Foreign Country. Dateline Oakwood. There was still a police presence Thursday morning at Oakwood District 76's schools, but Superintendent Gary Lewis said he believed it was safe for students and staff to return to class after a threatening email shut down the entire district Tuesday. Lewis, in consultation with the Vermilion County Sheriff's Department, publicly released information Wednesday night that the Sheriff's Department uncovered during the course of its investigation. I felt we owed it to our parents, Lewis said Thursday, adding that he had met with school board members individually to discuss the situation. We agreed we needed to get something out to the public. On Wednesday, a number of concerned Oakwood parents decided to keep their children home from school after becoming frustrated by the lack of information about the threat. Lewis's statement posted Wednesday night said, school officials, in cooperation with law enforcement officers, have made progress in determining the circumstances underlying the incident that resulted in the school closure on Tuesday. We believe that the release of additional information will no longer impede the investigation. On Monday evening, school officials received an email in which a death threat was made naming an Oakwood teacher. Threats were also made promising harm to the general school population. We have determined the threat was not made by anyone locally. Rather, information was obtained from a local source, and the threat was made by a person in a foreign country. The person who made the threat has been identified. We have every reason to believe that person will be held accountable, the statement read. When asked if the local source would face any kind of disciplinary action, Lewis said he had no comment. Lewis, who first discovered the email around 7 p.m. Monday, a day in which the school was canceled due to icy road conditions, said Thursday he had no indication that the email was from a foreign country. He decided to call off school on Tuesday in the interest of the safety of students and staff and requested a police presence in Oakwood's three schools on Wednesday and Thursday to reassure students and staff. My biggest thing is our students and staff are safe, he said. The police were here Thursday morning when the kids came in and stayed around until 10. I'm going to be over safe, he said. And the next is an opinion column. It's called Midwest Voices. And the title for this one is Democracy Isn't Always Pretty. Immigration remains a hot-button topic in the United States and in Southern Illinois. That's not an opinion, as this page is labeled. It is a fact borne out by the heated online discussion generated by the Southern Illinoisans' election of West Frankfurt's Juan Carlos Fernandez Pacheco as our Person of the Year. That selection has been roundly criticized, sometimes rationally, sometimes emotionally. By the same token, others have seen the selection for what it is. An opportunity to discuss one of the vexing, complicated, real-life issues of our time. People who view the selection as an homage to lawbreakers are missing the point. Hernandez puts a face, a local face, on a national issue. Too often, illegal immigration is discussed in terms of numbers. How many immigrants are here illegally? How many immigrants are illegally obtaining government benefits? And how many immigrants are committing crimes? Hernandez's story gets past the numbers. It puts a human face on what is clearly an emotional issue. For those unfamiliar with Hernandez's story, a brief synopsis. He came to this country illegally 20 years ago to find a job so he could send money back home to a sister who was ill. Hernandez eventually found his way to Marion, where he found work at La Fiesta. Eventually, he worked his way up to manager of the West Frankfurt location. In the meantime, he got married and started a family. He has been seeking legal status, but a pair of DUI convictions from 2007 and a stop at the U.S.-Mexican border have complicated that process. Hernandez quit drinking 7 years ago, but was arrested by ICE and ICE authorities in 2017 and imprisoned briefly. Which brings us to today. Hernandez is back in West Frankfurt, operating his restaurant. He and his family have assimilated into the community, providing employment opportunities for the restaurant staff, sponsoring sports teams, and holding benefits for a youth dance team, the local fire department, and other causes. Yet, Hernandez remains a lightning rod in the eyes of some people because he retains illegal status while navigating the twisting path that is the U.S. immigration system. Two of the major complaints heard about illegal immigrants are they don't learn English and they take rather than contribute to society. Hernandez has checked those items off his list. His struggles to learn English were well documented in a series of stories last week, and he has worked his way up from busboy to manager of a restaurant. If he had a different background, Hernandez's story might be seen as the embodiment of the American dream. The other common thread is the criticism of Hernandez is his illegal status. There are a couple of things to consider. First, he has been working diligently to achieve legal status. He is living in the open, not hiding from authorities. Second, illegal isn't synonymous with evil or dangerous. Throughout American history, laws and policies have been changed because of grassroots actions that at times involved activities deemed illegal. Remember, what Rosa Parks did on that Montgomery, Alabama bus was illegal. Some of the great advocates for social justice were arrested during their lives. Martin Luther King and Gandhi come to mind. And let's not forget, if a few skirmishes involving the Continental Army had gone the other way, many of our founding fathers would have found their way into English jails. Is that meant to compare Hernandez directly to Parks, King, and Gandhi? Absolutely not. But the movements championed by those leaders were populated by thousands who demonstrated in the streets or had the audacity to eat at lunch counters reserved for Caucasians. Democracy isn't always a pretty process. Hernandez's situation is a prime example. And now another opinion page with the title, Dancing Monkeys Break Bipartisan Hearts. Senator Lindsey Graham's reputation as an honorable conservative lies like a ripped up banana peel at the bottom of a baboon cage. What happened? What turned the principled voice of South Carolina, respected by Republicans and Democrats alike, into one of Donald Trump's dancing monkeys? During the 2016 primaries, Graham warned about Trump, "I think he's a kook, I think he's crazy, I think he's unfit for office." Those are the words of Graham. But 2 months ago, he used the exact same words to say the opposite. What concerns me about the American press is this endless attempt to label the man as some kind of kook, not fit to be president. Many Americans, including some Trump voters, had assumed that Republicans like Graham would contain the more destructive impulses of President Trump. But no, they've upped and gone to join the circus. One can laugh at Graham's slobbering tweets about all things Trump. For instance, Trump International Golf Club is a spectacular golf course. Not at all funny are his efforts to dismantle our democratic institutions on behalf of the ringmaster. I've known Lindsey Graham for many years and sat in the first meeting between him and John McCain, former McCain advisor John Weaver tweeted, "Couldn't be sadder today." What happened that day was Graham joined Senator Chuck Grassley in asking the Justice Department to investigate whether Christopher Steele, the British spy who gathered information unfavorable to Trump, lied to the FBI about contacts with journalists. The move has no logical purpose other than to feed the loopy theory that the FBI was conspiring against Trump. The monkeys are now running a legal protection racket for the president. As if smearing America's most respected law enforcement agency is the price, they'll let the nation pay it. Perhaps they can explain why the biased, that's in quotes, FBI is also investigating the Clinton Foundation. The Simeon chorus line includes Senator Orrin, "You are a heck of a leader, Hatch." The Utahn played a key role in passing a tax bill that shovels more of the nation's wealth to the top 1% and explodes deficits. Afterwards, Hatch called Trump one of the best presidents ever. The Salt Lake Tribune was less flattering to Hatch, citing him for, quote, "utter lack of integrity," close quote. As for Graham, the evidence gathers that he was never quite the statesman he once played for the cameras. His bill aiming at Kalashnikov at the Affordable Care Act was a sop to the rich donors. "The financial contributions will stop if not passed," he said as an explanation. Collapsing poll numbers for Trump and associated Republicans suggest a rapidly growing displeasure with their performance. So what could possibly be the motive for alarming voters and looking clownish at the same time? Some Republicans may figure that with the political winds blowing against them, the time may be ripe to do favors for the plutocrats in exchange for cushy lobbying jobs. Hatch just said he's not running again. Wonder what he has in mind. Some speculate that when Trump is gone, Graham and his ilk will say that they hung in to ensure that the country didn't collapse under Trumpian chaos. They were a stabilizing influence. If that were the case, they would simply shower Trump with servile adulation but stop at trying to sabotage Robert Mueller's investigation. To recap, the former FBI director is looking into possible collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia, plus obstruction of justice. Some lawmakers dancing for the organ grinder never showed much promise as national leaders. One could weep at the fall of those who did, but spare the tears. Better that we know about them now. This has been Lois Pausch reading the Vermilion County News for Friday, January 12, 2018. I look forward to reading with you again soon.